It should be a little bit shorter today. I knew that we were going to have this ceremony today. So, what do the following scenarios have in common? A child throwing a tantrum at Walmart. Nobody's ever seen a child throw a tantrum at Walmart, I know. Politicians using profanity in pre-written speeches. Comedians using gory images to express their right to free speech. Or a man taking a gun to solve some unsettled irritations that he has in his life. What do all of those have in common? The title of the sermon today is One of the Fruits of the Spirit Called Self-Control. When you look at all of those scenarios, these people just don't exhibit self-control. Let's review each of those. A tantrum in Walmart. It seems like there are less and less parents that care whether or not their kids are screaming when they're at Walmart. They just ignore them. I promise you, if that had happened to me when I was young, it would have happened once. And I would have had a flattened back of the head, and I would have never done it again. But the children are just allowed to throw a fit. I was watching a newscast. I was shocked when I heard it. Now, obviously, it was bleeped out. But one of our senators, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, was at a college rally to express her discontent for our current administration. And it was a pre-written speech laced with profanity. And she stopped at one point, got away from her script, and looked up and said, "It's okay that I use that language here because it's a young audience." This is an elected politician with a pre-written speech laced with the absolute worst of the worst words. You probably saw the one where Kathy Griffin held up, that one. But if you think back a few months before that, there was a rapper that even had someone dressed up to look like President Trump in clown face, and he put a gun against his head and pulled the trigger. You remember seeing that? Just a totally lack of control. What got me thinking about that this week was obviously the shooting at the baseball diamond in Virginia. As several of our congressmen were trying to practice for a baseball game. The lack of self-control in this world, to me, is at a level that it hasn't been in a long time. People just aren't paying attention to what they're doing. And in light of what happened this week, I thought that I would discuss self-control, not only from what's going on in the world, but what should we be doing? Should we be controlling ourselves as well? I'd like to start in 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. And read verses 1 through 5. I have actually used this a lot. This is one of the go-to scriptures that seem to come out 4 or 5 times a year. It's an important one. And it starts out in verse 1 by saying, "Know this, that in the last days perilous times will come." So Paul is going to be explaining to Timothy what he sees the world like as the age comes to a close, an age which we believe we're living in now. Notice what it says. It says, "Men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemies, disobedient to parents." Think of the kid in Walmart. "Unthankful, unholy, unthankful." I mean, people should be so blessed to live in a country like this, and yet they just don't seem to be thankful. Verse 3, "unloving, unforgiving, slanderers," and notice, "without self-control." People in the end time are going to be more and more without self-control. Something that we need to be watching for in our lives as we live in this world. As the world continues to go one direction, we need to be going the other, away from this lack of self-control. Turn to Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5, I want to read verses 16 through 18 to start with. I want you to notice something interesting that the Apostle Paul says. Galatians 5, starting in verse 16. "But I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh." He's going to try and make a distinction between walking in a spirit way of or frame of mind and walking in a fleshly way of mind. Verse 17, for the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. They're contrary to one another, so that you don't do the things that you wish. But if you're led by the Spirit of God, you're not under the law, you're not under this death penalty anymore. The flesh pulls you one direction, the spirit pulls you another. Something that we need to be watching as this age comes to a close. Now, what I want to do is, I'm going to come back to verse 19 in a minute, but I want to drop down to verse 22 and read how we should be living. I want to ask you to ask yourselves, when I'm at work, when I'm at school, when I'm with the people in Walmart, is this how people see of me? Verse 22, the fruit of the Spirit, if you're being led by the Spirit of God, is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and then look at the last one on the list, self-control. Sometimes you think about, well, yes, I need to have joy and I need to have peace, but it's saying that if you are being led by the Holy Spirit, you will have control over yourself. You won't vent, you won't get angry, you won't go out there and do things that you shouldn't do. You will have self-control. You know, as I was reading through this list, I was thinking of back when I was managing people at this telecommunications company that I used to work for. I had a couple of people that they were always happy. They were always joyful. They were always peaceful. They came to work with a smile on their face. They worked hard. They were a joy to have around. But I also had a couple that came in with an attitude. And they had to have a cup of coffee before they could smile. And they were grumpy. And they didn't want to go to meetings. Oh, and they rolled their eyes a lot. You know, things that you just want to kind of smack out of your teenager sometime. They would do, you know what I'm saying? There are some people that express joy and peace and love, and then there are some people that you think, boy, I wish I didn't have that person on my team. As I read through this list here, when you're at work, when you're at school, do people see joy? Do they see peace? Do they see long-suffering? Do they see someone that exercises self-control? You know, as I look at this list, I almost wish that the Apostle Paul had listed self-control first. Because in actuality, you can't have any of the rest of them if you don't have self-control. Example, you can't really love someone if it's all about you. If it's all about you. You can't be peaceful if you can't control your anger. You can't be long-suffering if you get really frustrated with people. You have to have self-control before you can have any of those things. Now let's look at the opposite. Let's go back to verse 19. The works of the flesh. Now, the works of the Spirit, we just read, love, joy, peace. The works of the flesh are evident. They are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, and lewdness. That's a lack of self-control. You have a desire to do something that you shouldn't do, that's lewd, that's unclean, fornication, or adultery, and you act on that. It's a lack of self-control. Verse 20, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, like the kid in Walmart. That's not self-control. That is the works of the flesh. That is what we should be getting rid of. Dissensions, heresies, envies, murders, like this man who had a, he had a whole list, by the way. I don't know if you saw the news. He had a list in his pocket of senators that he was out gunning for. If the Capitol Police hadn't been there, we could have lost 10% of our senators in a matter of half an hour. So obviously, they're going to have to make some changes to that because of this. But I was talking to Marlis, what if that had been five guys with AR-15s from Al-Qaeda or something like that? They could have taken out, I don't know if any of you watched the show Designated Survivor, but that's the theory behind that is that the Capitol building gets blown up when the president's giving a speech to the entire Congress and everybody dies. Almost scary to think about. But when you go through this list, let's keep going. Drunkenness, revelries, drinking too much, partying too much, using language that you shouldn't use. That is a lack of self-control. Outbursts of wrath. I want to give you a couple of examples from the Bible of people that used a lack of self-control in their lives. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 4, and let's read an obvious one. You all will know as soon as I start reading this what we're going to be talking about. But perhaps you haven't thought about it in light of the fact that this gentleman did not control himself, but he allowed himself to be controlled. Genesis chapter 4. Start in verse 1. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain. And she said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. Then she bore again, and this time his brother Abel. Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain was a tiller of the ground. Both very important. You needed people to grow plants. You needed people to take care of the livestock. For Adam and Eve and their growing family, they needed both of these types of businesses. It's not that one business was right and the other was wrong. This was both needed. Verse 3, and in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Eternal, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. So they both bring an offering, right? So everything's good so far. They both are bringing an offering to God. Verse 4. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock, and the Lord respected Abel in his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. Now, full stop. Let's stop reading here for a minute. What, at that point in time, should have happened? If you do something, teenagers, you do something and against what your parents say, and your parents catch you, what do you do? Well, let me tell you, the first thing you should do is say, I'm sorry, Mom, or I'm sorry, Dad. And that would have been the obvious thing to me. We're going to see as we go through here, Cain had a lot of options here. He could have stopped this at any point in time. So God doesn't like his offering. You think about it. Why wouldn't Cain have gone up to God and said, okay, I'm sorry, I must not have done this right. What could I do to make this better next time? And God would have said, well, here's what you do. And this whole thing could have been averted. But he didn't practice self-control. Notice what the next thing it says. But he did not respect Cain and his offering, and Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. All right? We're heading down the wrong path now. That's not the direction that Cain should have been going. Not only did he not stop and repent, now he's irritated. And he's going to let his irritation get hotter and hotter and hotter. Verse 6, he still has a chance here. Listen to this. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? It's almost like someone stepping in and saying, hey, come on, guy, settle down. What are you doing? Why are you so upset? And this is actually God talking to him. This is God telling him, why are you angry and why is your countenance fallen? Verse 7, if you do well, if you fix the problem, won't you be accepted? Won't your offering be accepted? So God's actually like intervening here, and he's saying, you didn't ask me for my opinion, but here, if you would just do this, this would solve it all. Will you not be accepted? But if you don't do well, if you don't control yourself, what does it say? Sin lies at your door. And he almost personifies this here. I think this is interesting how it's worded. And it, that's sin, its desire is for you. It's almost like sin is a person and it wants you badly. And what happens if it does? Its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. You should exhibit self-control. Sin can't get you. I remember as a kid going up to Mom, and I would be reading in the Bible in the evenings, and I'm 6, 7, 8 years old, and I'd read something about Satan or demon possession or something, and I would get kind of creeped out over it, and I would say, well, Satan's this big scary guy, and I can remember Mom saying, all you have to do is resist him, and he has to flee from you. Basically what God is telling him here. If sin desires you, if you resist it, it's gone. It can't take effect of you. So what is he telling Cain? Stop right now. I know you didn't like the fact that your offering wasn't accepted, and I know that you're angry, but you can still turn this around. And he's giving him an out. Here's how to fix this. I want to read verse 8. You can follow along in the New King James, but I actually want to read this from the Septuagint. There are several versions, the Vulgate, the Syriac, the Septuagint, and the Samaritan Pentateuch, that has a different wording, or actually has an extra sentence in here that's not in the King James, and it might even be in your marginal notes. But I'm going to read this again from the Septuagint. Verse 8. Now Cain talked with his brother Abel and said, let's go out to the field. This is premeditated. You don't see that in the King James. It just says he talked with his brother and then something happened. This says, Cain talked with his brother Abel and said, let's go out to the field. And it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Premeditated murder. It isn't that they just happened to be out in the field and Cain just snapped. He had the choice to do this. He premeditated this. I think of the gunman who's living in Illinois, and he practices, and he gets in his van, and he drives, and he was actually living in the parking lot across from where this baseball field was, just waiting for the time. This was premeditated. This was set up. It's what Cain was doing. Cain set this up. He didn't exercise self-control, and he let his thoughts turn to anger. He let his anger turn to action, and he ended up committing murder. He lured his brother into the field and committed murder. There are so many points along this story, 6, 7, 8 times, that he could have turned this around, and yet he didn't. He allowed his hatred to stem to where he finally plotted harm and committed murder. Let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 16. Here's a second story that I find very relevant to today. 2 Samuel chapter 16. We have a very divided and polarized country today. We've got the us's and the them's. We got the conservatives and the liberals, or the Republicans and the Democrats, or the gun-toters and the non-gun-toters. I mean, you can come up with any. It reminds me of a Crosby, Stills, and Nash song that said, people carrying placards, and most of them say, hooray for our side. Right? I mean, it doesn't matter what the issue is. That you've just got this huge divide in thinking. It's happened in 2 Samuel chapter 16. Let's read this. Let's see, where do I want to start? Verse 5. Now when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man there from the family of the house of Saul. Who's that? The house of Saul is the other guys. They were the ones that were in power. And now David is in power. So you can almost see this as almost like a Republican-Democrat thing. It's like, well, our guys are not in power now, so what are we going to do? Of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there. And he came out, and he cursed continually as he came. Boy, he's mad. So here's how it starts. He starts by letting his anger become profanity, and he's cursing at David. Verse 6, but it didn't stop there. It escalates further. And then he threw stones at David, and at all the servants of David, and all the people, and all the mighty men that were on his right hand and his left hand. Not only is he mad, not only is he cussing, but now he's picking rocks up and he's throwing rocks at people. This is starting to escalate. He's not exercising self-control. He's getting out of the way. I want you to notice now what the other side does. These are the good guys, right? Well, let's read a little further first. Also, Shimei said, thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. And he just tells all these terrible things about David. And also, he's laughing at the fact that Absalom is trying to take the throne away from David. You know, let's get it away from you and let's get it back to somebody else because, you know, our side, their side, our side, their side. Verse 9, these are the good guys. Notice what it says. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to King David, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head. Okay, how did we get from cussing to throwing stones to now wanting to cut someone's head off? It reminds me of Kathy Griffin, whatever her name is, holding up that gory head. This is escalating. This is going in the wrong direction. This is not self-control on Shimei's point, but it is also not self-control on Abishai's side. They're letting it get out of hand. Fortunately, we have King David, who didn't always make the right choices, but notice what he says. Verse 10, then King David said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? Let him curse, because the Lord said to him, go curse David. Who shall say then, why have you done this? Then David said to Abishai and all of his servants, my son Absalom, who's come from my own body, seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjamite? Let him alone, let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered it. It may be that the Eternal will look on my affliction, and he will repay me with good for this cursing this day. David's the one that pulls it back. No, we're not going to cut anybody's head off. No, we're not going to throw stones back. No, we're not going to curse back. Just leave him alone. Let him curse. That's exercising self-control. Do you think it hurt David when he got pelted in the head with a stone? Yeah, for all I know, he could have been bleeding by this time. But he had the presence of mind to say, no, we're going to let this rest. We're going to de-escalate this. Has anybody ever heard of Godwin's Law? So would be curious if anybody has ever heard of that. Godwin's Law. It's a sociology professor that came up with this saying, which I think is really cute. It was about online blogs, how it's real easy to talk in an online blog under the name Anonymous, because you can say things and nobody knows who you are, so it just escalates. It's like kids in the playground. You're fat. Am not. Am too. Am not. And all of a sudden they're wrestling. Online blogs get like that, where it just escalates and escalates and escalates. So here's his maxim. It's called Godwin's Law. As an online discussion grows longer, the probability of one side comparing the other to Adolf Hitler approaches one. Right? You see that? It actually happened in the news. As I was putting this on here, kind of chuckling to myself because I had heard this many years ago. I was on Fox News, and the story popped up, and there's some beer maker in Germany that put on its label, they've got a picture of Donald Trump with a swastika and the Hitler mustache and all that. I thought, okay, here, we finally got Godwin's Law worked on CNN or wherever it was. I had to laugh. It's not funny, but I had to laugh. We are told through what we saw in 2 Timothy 3 that as the end times become more perilous, people will have less control of themselves. How can we learn, brethren, as members of the Church of God, to control ourselves in a world that is increasingly in less control of itself? It's very easy for us to get swept up into this. I see a lot of postings on Facebook from a lot of people that I know in the church, and it's getting more ratcheted up and more amped up. Can we pull away from that and get some self-control in ourselves? I want you to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. And while you're turning there, I wanted to tell you just something personal. This is a personal comment. This isn't church doctrine. I always want to be very careful when I say things like this. I don't know that anybody else in the church or in headquarters would feel this, but I just want to make a comment. If you've got a Bible like mine, over chapter 10 of 2 Corinthians, it's got a title. It says, A Spiritual War. We are in a spiritual war. Remember what I read earlier? The spirit wants to go one direction, but the flesh wants to pull you another way. We are in a war that is a spiritual war. If you look, this is my personal comment, if you look through time at how Satan has manifested himself to humanity, how did he manifest himself to Adam and Eve? As a serpent, a talking serpent. You see many talking serpents out there today? That's not how Satan acts around people. He did at one point in time, but he changes his tactics along the way. You know, if we saw a talking serpent come up to us, we'd all go, oh, no, there's something wrong there. Right? So he doesn't want to use that one. He's used that already. Now he's got to move on to something else. If you look in the days of the New Testament, you see many people there with Christ and with the early apostles that were healing people that were demon-possessed. What was Satan doing at that point in time with that possession? Well, they were making people dumb, meaning they couldn't talk, making them deaf, blind. God was healing people that were like that. I was at a ministerial conference once, and I heard a longtime church pastor relating about what it was like in the early days of his ministry in the 1960s. And he said that they would go out on visits and would see people that were possessed with demons. But he said it's not that they were deaf, blind, and dumb, like you would read in the New Testament. He said most of the time they were silly or arrogant or just kind of nonsensical, but they weren't harmful or anything like that. They just were kind of goofy. And he said, fortunately, probably from the 1980s on, we don't see much of that anymore. It's almost like Satan changed his tactic, and that's not what he does. I am very happy as a new pastor to not go visit people and have to deal with that. I'm very glad that Satan doesn't do that. However, again, personal opinion, when I look at what's happening in the news, I see a very active Satan working with the minds of people to get them out of self-control, to make them angry. The rhetoric and all of that is getting so bad now, and it can be on absolutely anything. You name whatever topic you want, and you're going to have this huge debate and this anger that gets built up. So how can we in a world of rhetoric and violence, how can we self-control? Why would this section in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 be called a spiritual war? Let's read through several verses and see what Paul's talking about. Verse 1, now I, Paul myself, am pleading with you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. It's interesting that he starts out that way. Christ isn't an out-of-control God. And if I could say this, thank God that he is a patient and loving and caring and gentle being. I don't know that I could be as gentle and patient as he is if I were in charge of myself. I probably would have blown myself up a long time ago. But he's not like that. He's gentle. And Paul talks about that. Verse 3, for though we walk in the flesh, meaning even though we are flesh, we shouldn't war according to the flesh. Now, that's a really tall statement. You know what he's saying there? While you're in this human body, don't act like a human. Why? We shouldn't be acting like you. If we've got the Spirit of God, we should be acting like God. You're still human. You still got the pull of the flesh, but you need to be acting like God and not like a human. Does God expect us to be human and yet resist the pull of Satan? Exactly. That's exactly what he's trying to say. I know it's a tall order. Look at the start of verse 4. For the weapons of our warfare, oh, here it comes. We got weapons. Yay. You know, let's go fight. Let's read through this and see what weapons are like. Because sometimes you can read this and almost think it looks like it. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God. We can pull down strongholds. Yeah, let's go rip, you know, fences down and let's get in there and take over. Is that what it's saying? Well, you know, a lot of commentaries would say that that's what this is saying. But I would just ask you the question, what is a stronghold? It's a defense. What if you can handle yourself in such a way that you can pull down people's defenses, right? If people are up there and they want to fight you and you don't have any fight in you, you can pull down defenses by being calm. Let's read on. Notice what else it says. Weapons of our warfare are not carnal but mighty in God. They can pull down strongholds. They can cast down arguments. If you don't argue with the person back, there's no argument, right? They can be yelling at you and screaming at you, and if there is nothing back, then eventually they're going to run out of steam or run out of voice, as happens to me when I talk too long. My kids used to tell me this when they would say that when I got mad when they were young and I had a temper, which I did. I don't have that much anymore, but I did at the time. They knew that I had a weak voice, so they knew that as I would start yelling that I would eventually get hoarse and I would stop. So they told me later on that they used to laugh about that. It's like, yeah, you know, Dad will get mad, but he can only get mad for so long because then he gets hoarse. But notice what it says here. You can pull down arguments and everything that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. How? By bringing every thought into captivity. That's self-control. It's basically what it's saying there. You can bring down arguments. You can bring down people's defenses if you bring every thought into captivity. Why does he say that? Because thoughts lead to actions. And if you stop the thought before it becomes an action, you control yourself. And that's what Paul's trying to say here. Bring every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. That's what we need to do. We can stop an argument. We can break down barriers. We can repel things that resist against the truth of God. But we have to do it through bringing thought into captivity. We have to control ourselves. Go to Romans chapter 6. I want to start in verse 12. Romans 6 and in verse 12. This is Paul talking to a group of Gentile converts that had come into the church. It says, don't let sin reign in your mortal bodies that you should obey its lusts. Obeying is a mental process. Obeying isn't, it's not like you've got, you're addicted to picking a sword up and taking someone's head off. He's saying you can stop sin and not obey it. That is a mental process. This is a mental warfare that's going on, a mental struggle. To obey a lust starts in the mind, and that's where you need to control it. Verse 13, don't present your members as instruments of unrighteousness to sin. Again, it reminds me of the guy that took the rifle into that ball field. He used his members, his body, as an instrument of sin. Don't let yourself do that. But present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness to God. Instead of being an instrument of sin, you become an instrument of righteousness. And then notice this very positive statement in verse 14. If you do that, if you let your members, your body, be instruments of righteousness, sin shall not have dominion over you. You can conquer sin. Just like my mom used to tell me when I was a kid, you resist it and he flees. He has to leave you. The big bad boogeyman is not so big bad as long as you resist him and he has to leave. That is a promise. Paul was saying the same thing here. If you use your body as instruments of righteousness to God, sin shall not have dominion over you. That's a very positive statement. Do we recognize, brethren, the warning signs when we start to lose control? I'm going to tell you some of mine. Now, this is kind of personal here, but maybe it'll help you. Maybe some of these you'll recognize yourself. Warning signs that you're about to lose control. When you lose control of your voice, and your voice starts getting louder and louder and louder. Nobody else does that. I know everybody in this room is always really calm, and I'm the only one that does that. But when I get irritated, my voice gets louder, and then it gets weaker if I keep going. The temperature in the room seems to suddenly rise. I have been in rooms before where people have gotten into an argument. All of a sudden, you see someone pulling a fan out, going, whoo! All right? That's a sign. Now, not every time that you're fanning yourself, but if nobody else is fanning and you're fanning and you've been in an argument, that should be a sign that you're starting to lose control. Your word usage changes. Get a little stronger in your talk. Words like dumb and stupid start coming out, words that you don't normally use. That's a sign. How about the use of superlatives? She always does this. He never does that. Sorry, always and never. That just isn't how it really works. A person isn't always rebellious. Kids are good most of the time, right? They sleep 8 hours out of the day. I want to read something to you. Sometimes reading can get a little dull, but I really liked this. I was looking, as I was putting the sermon together, I looked up things on how to become self-controlled. And there is a Dr. Carmen Harra, H-A-R-R-A. She's written a column on 6 steps to control your emotions. And as I read through this, I was really surprised. Now, she is not a religious person like we would think of it. She talks to the universe instead of to God and all of that. So this is a little, you know, nutso at some points. But if you look at what she says and you apply it to what the Bible says, there are some really, really good principles in here. And I want to read this. 6 steps to controlling your emotions. Step 1. Don't react right away. Great advice. Don't react right away. She says, reacting immediately to emotional triggers can be an immense mistake. You know, the very first, something happens, and what's the very first thing you want to do? You want to yell. You want to solve it. I don't want this problem in my life, and I'm going to stop it right here. And it usually ends up, you get angry, and you head down a path that you don't go. It is guaranteed, reading again, it is guaranteed you will say or do something that you'll later regret. How many times with my kids growing up did I lose my temper with them and then later on had to go back and apologize to them? You know, as a parent, you don't want to be constantly apologizing to your kid, but I did. When I got to the place where I realized, you know, I crossed the line. I shouldn't have done that. I have to go back and apologize to them. Don't react right away. I'll tell you a story. I think I've told you this before, too. My dad, when I knew what his trigger was, when he would get, he was left-handed and had a watch on his left hand, a really nice watch. And he didn't want to hurt that watch when he would spank me, and spankings were not calm with my father. He would take the watch off his left wrist and put it on his right wrist. And that was the last step before Phil got a spanking. So I learned that I could push him up to moving his watch from one wrist to the other, and then I would stop. And then I think Dad got to the place where he realized all I have to do to get Phil to stop is move my watch. And it just, it was kind of a dance that we did, but that was a trigger. Don't react right away. Before refuting the trigger with your emotional argument, take a deep breath, stabilize the overwhelming impulse, continue to breathe deeply, feel your muscles untense, feel your heart rate return to normal, and as you become calmer, affirm yourself that this is only temporary. Right? This anger thing that you're going through, this, you know, if it's a teenager with his parents or a husband and a wife or something that your boss at work, whatever it might be, is the argument's not going to last forever. And you have to convince yourself as you step back and you take a breath, this is temporary. Think about it even from the spiritual perspective. We've said this a million times here. We're here for 80-something years, and then the kingdom of God is eternity. Billions and billions and billions of years. Whatever you're going through now is not going to affect eternity. So take a step back. Don't react right away. Point one. Point two, ask for divine guidance. It's always interesting to hear somebody who is not a religious person say this. Faith is our saving grace in our darkest moments. Developing a healthy relationship with the divine world will help you surmount your obstacles more easily. Why? It's very interesting. Listen to this point. It's very, very perceptive. This is because when you believe in a higher force, you also believe in the power of divine intervention that can show you what you must do and teach you why something is happening or even save you from a certain unwanted situation. When burdened with emotion, close your eyes, talk to the universe, which is what she says, to illuminate the best path forward. It's great advice. Step one, you don't react right away. What's step two? God, I don't want to lose it. I want to know how to handle this. What's the way forward? And before you even respond, start praying about it. How am I going to handle this? That helps you keep self-control. Now you're asking God, go back to Cain. Cain didn't want God's advice. God was giving him advice. But what if Cain had gone to God and said, what can I do to resolve this? God would have helped him. And that whole scenario of the murdering of his brother wouldn't have happened. Ask for divine guidance. Point three, find a healthy outlet. Now that you've managed your emotions, you'll need to release that in some way. You can't, keeping it bottled up is not good. You know, you might keep from yelling at someone, but if you go home and you're just seething inside, that's not a good thing either. You need to find a healthy release. Emotions should never be bottled up. And she gives a couple of examples here. You can keep a journal, not an online blog where you're not that person, whatever, that's not what I'm talking about. But you can write your stuff down in a journal. You know, this happened today and it was really hurtful and whatever. And that helps take the tension through your hand onto a piece of paper or onto a keyboard. She says, many people find help in engaging in aggressive exercises. Now, she specifically mentioned things like karate and whatever. I don't do that, but maybe if you're just losing it, maybe the right thing to do is to get on your bicycle and ride, right? I mean, that is a stress relief. You know what is a stress relief for me? Golfing. You're out there, and it's beautiful green and blue sky and sand traps, which is not the most positive part of golf, but it's stress relief to me. You can go out there and you can whack a ball and it feels great and you're out in nature. It's a thing you can do to release. Find healthy outlets. Other people meditate or turn to a tranquil state of being. Meditation is, you pray to God and then you sit down and you study his Bible and you think about the word of God. That is a relief. Perform whatever activity is best suited for you to liberate the pent-up sentiments. Point four, see the bigger picture. This is really key, I think. Again, talking about living 80 years as a human and eternity as a God. See the bigger picture. Every happening in our lives, whether good or bad, serves a higher purpose. Remember when Paul went to God and said, he went to God three times and said, take this problem away from me. And God said, no, I'm not going to take it away from you. This is actually good for you. And Paul came to realize, me having this trial is teaching me patience, teaching me faith, growing up and having issues with your parents or issues with your kids or your spouse or whatever, you can learn from them. There's value. So why lose it and make a situation worse when you can actually look at whatever it is that's going on and see there's something that needs to be learned here. I need to learn something. They need to learn something. Probably we both need to learn something. So try and see that aspect of it. She goes on to say, wisdom means being able to see past the moment and discern the greater meaning of any given situation. You may not understand it at the beginning, but as time goes by, you'll begin to see the bigger picture falling into perfect order. Even in the midst of an emotionally upsetting moment, trust that there exists an ultimate purpose which you will come to comprehend. Now, again, personal note. Is there a higher purpose for the political wrangling that's going on in this country right now? I actually see a positive outcome of this if I think about it. And I think you'll agree. At one point in time, and you can choose anybody, it could be the man with the gun or the lady with the holding up the gory head. At some point in time, God's going to have a chat with them in the resurrection. And he's going to say, do you remember that little stunt you did? And they're going to say, yeah, you remember that. Roll the tape. Let's watch the film. And they're going to, I think, come to a realization, you know, Satan really had control over me. I am really sorry. I mean, I think they're going to come to a place God's going to say, you know, Satan's not around now. Do you feel a difference? And they're going to stop and they're going to say, yeah, I mean, I don't feel that anger welling up inside me. That was Satan. And I think that God will be able to use this for these people eventually. They're going to look back at this and it's going to be a positive teaching moment for God. And it's going to be tough for right now while we're in the middle of it. And that's why I'm giving this. We are in the middle of this. We have to be protecting ourselves from losing it in a world that is continually losing it. So see the bigger picture. Point five, replace your thoughts. Negative emotions bind us to recurring negative thoughts, creating cycles of negative patterns. I actually did this in a sermon not too long ago. If something happens and your first response is to get angry, then when something else happens later on that's similar to it, you have this muscle memory that says, oh, I'm going to lock my fist, or I'm going to yell, or I'm going to do something. And then the next time something happens, you keep reaching for that same tool. If you get to the place where if something happens, you kind of follow these steps, okay, I'm not going to react, right? Then the next time that happens, the first thing in your mind is not to blow up. The first thing in your mind is, I need to go check the mail, even though you've already checked it three times that day. Right? I need to go somewhere. That is the tool that you go to. I need to think about this. I need to put this in perspective. Replace your thoughts. Whenever you're confronted with an emotion which makes you feel or think something bad, force it out of your mind and replace it with a different thought. It's kind of the idea of, how do you get air out of a glass? You fill it with water. You don't suck the air out. You replace it with something. Imagine the ideal solution to your problem playing out, and it should at some point in time even make you smile. There's going to be an outcome to this. Replace those thoughts. And then finally, point six in her list is forgive your emotional triggers. Now, we had sermons on forgiving yourself, forgiving others, and God forgiving us, right? Forgive your emotional triggers. Your emotional triggers may be your best friend, it may be a family member, or it may be yourself, right? You have to be able to forgive all of those if there's a problem. You may feel a sudden wave of anger when your friend does that thing she always does, and it's boom, all of a sudden you just have this angry moment. You need to be able to forgive your best friend. Forgive your child. Forgive, right? But also forgive yourself. You can also have a stab of self-loathing when you remember something that you've done that you shouldn't have done. You have to be able to forgive your emotional triggers. I thought there were just six very good points, and I wanted to bring them out today because I think that they're very useful in us in this world. What I want to do now is I want to go to the book of Proverbs, and I just want to read through a whole series of these. If you don't want to turn to them, you can just listen. If you take notes, you write them down, and you can look them up later if you want. The book of Proverbs has hundreds, if not thousands, of verses that I could read that are just like the seven or so that I'm going to read here. But I just wanted to just give you some. This might even be a good study for you to do one of these days. Look up words like the tongue, or control, or anger, And you'll see a lot of those in the book of Proverbs that will help you understand how to deal with your tongue or with anger or with loss of control. Proverbs chapter 4, let's go to verse 23 and start here. Proverbs 4, verse 23. Keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life. Another version of this says, guard your heart, right? Protect it, because your heart can get hurt. And if your heart gets hurt, then you can react in a bad way. This is saying, keep your heart or protect your heart. Verse 24, put away from you a deceitful mouth and put perverse lips far from you. Again, the senator that read that profanity-laced thing, did I talk about that? Did I say that? Where she had written that. She made a point later in that speech. She stopped and said, oh, it's okay for me to use profanity because I'm speaking to a young audience. Right? It was planned. One of these days, I think God's going to read this to her. Put away a deceitful mouth and put perverse lips far from you. Oh, yeah. Boy, I shouldn't have done that. And we shouldn't either. Verse 25, let your eyes look straight ahead and your eyelids look right before you. Ponder the path of your feet and let all your ways be established. Don't turn to the right or to the left to remove your foot from evil. I think of David, and he's got Shimei over there on the side, and he's pelting him. He's cursing and pelting him. And David is telling his guys, let's keep our eye on the path. Let's just keep walking. He's eventually going to run out of steam. Don't allow yourself to get focused on the problem. You stay focused on the direction you're supposed to go, and it'll help calm you down. Proverbs chapter 10. Proverbs chapter 10 and in verse 19. Read this out of the New King James first, then I'm going to read it out of the Amplified Bible. Proverbs 10, verse 19. In the multitude of words, sin is not lacking, but he who restrains his lips is wise. Let me read this from the Amplified Version. I love the way this is stated. It says, when there are many words, transgressions and offenses are unavoidable. Right? If you're in the middle of an argument and you keep arguing, it's just going to get worse. If you keep using words, it's going to keep getting to the place where it's the transgression and offense. You know, you're eventually going to offend someone. You're eventually going to get so irritated. Now, again, I know nobody else does this, but have you ever gotten into that thing where you've got to have the last word? And you say something and then you think, okay, well, that's it. And then the other person's, well, but... And then now you've got to say it, and you even eventually get to the place where you think you're ending it by saying, now we're not going to talk about this anymore, right? That really isn't ending it. That's continuing to inflame the situation. Now, I know nobody does that except me, but you get to the place where if you restrain your lips, then you have wisdom. When there are many words, transgressions and offenses are unavoidable, but he who controls his lips and keeps thoughtful silence is wise. Proverbs 15 in verse 28. Proverbs 15 in verse 28. The heart of the righteous studies how to answer. That's different. That's not the heart of a wise man just reacts at the first possible second. He studies how to answer. He thinks about it. What's the right solution here? God, help me out. What's the right thing to say? The heart of a righteous studies how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked just spews out evil. I mean, it just comes out of you just very, very fast. It's very easy to do. God says that the righteous person weighs his heart and tries to figure out the right way to answer it. That requires time, it requires patience, and it is something that is, again, very hard to do if the first thing is normally to be upset about it. Chapter 17, three more, and then we'll bring this to a conclusion. Proverbs 17, in verse 27. Very simple statement, but very, very clear when it comes to providing self-control. He who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is of a calm spirit. Again, you can't have an argument with someone if you stop talking. If you use few words, now I'm not saying think about just that right word to really stab them in the heart. Now, that's not what I'm talking about either. You're talking about just not continuing to keep the problem going. Spare your words. Chapter 21, verse 23. Chapter 21, verse 23. I like the way this is worded. Whoever guards his mouth and his tongue will keep his soul from trouble. If you guard it, right? What does guard mean? It means you protect what's coming out of your mouth. I think sometimes about, as I was thinking about this morning, when a dog overheats, he pants. It's almost like when we get angry and we start to get our blood boiling, it's like we want to open our mouth to vent some of that heat out because somehow we think that's going to make us feel better. But we're not a dog that needs to pant. The more we expel words and the more we talk like that, the harder it is for us to get over it. If you guard your mouth and your tongue, you will keep your soul from trouble. And the last one, Proverbs 29, verse 11. This is my favorite, that's why I saved it for last. Proverbs 29, verse 11. It says, a fool vents all his feelings. You know what to vent is, right? You just open and just blah. You just vent all. A fool is going to vent his feelings, but a wise man will hold them back. Self-control. All of these verses, and again, there's hundreds more just like this, help us to understand self-control. Brethren, we're in a world that is surrounded by an increasingly angry world, and we live in a world that has an increasingly dangerous spirit, the spirit of Satan. How can we reflect on God's word and understand what his desire is for us as we live in a world that is increasingly out of control? Two more verses and then we're done. Titus chapter 1 in verse 8. Titus chapter 1 in verse 8. This is Paul talking to Titus. Paul is an elderly minister talking to a young minister, new in the job, and he's trying to help Titus. Perhaps Titus had a temper. Don't know. It doesn't say, but Paul's obviously talking to him, and he tells him, when you go from place to place to place, I want you ordaining ministers and leave them there while you go on travel, but there's a certain type of person that I want. Look at verse 8. This is the type of person that you should look for. Hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy, and self-controlled. Now, this is talking about the ministry, but I'm telling you, if you look at the scriptures that talk about we're going to be a kingdom of priests, you all are in training to be in the ministry. Men, women, young, old, we will all be there one of these days if we follow God's law. He wants you to be under control of yourself. In a world that is increasingly in less control, he wants you to have control. Let's finish in 2 Peter chapter 1. 2 Peter 1, verse 2. Grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and of our Lord Jesus Christ. Grace and peace. I want you to notice the words that he uses all the way through here. Nothing in here about anger or fighting or resentment. Grace and peace. Verse 3, as his divine power has given to us all things that pertain to life and godliness. We have grace, peace, life, godliness through the knowledge. See all these words that he's using that helps us understand how to be able to control ourselves. Through the knowledge of him who was called to us by glory and virtue. These are the things that we need to have in our life. By which, having been given to us exceedingly great and precious promises, that through these you may be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in this world through lust. All of us have been called with a very special calling. We've been given a tremendous blessing. We have been given access to God's Holy Spirit. Verse 5, but also for this very reason, give all diligence, add to your faith virtue, to your virtue knowledge, and to your knowledge self-control. He wants that in you. You are to be developing self-control. From self-control, perseverance, godliness, and godliness, to brotherly kindness and brotherly kindness to love. So brethren, as we go back into this world today, we may get out in the parking lot and someone cuts us off and the anger comes right. I want to tell you this in all sincerity. I don't even honk my horn anymore because I'm afraid someone's going to pull a gun out and shoot me. I just would rather let them cut me off and I don't use my horn anymore. It's just something that I've stopped doing. Brethren, as we live in this age, we need to learn that there is a dangerous spirit out there. And while we are here, we need to learn to control our mind. We need to learn to control our body. And we need to learn to control our spirit. If we do that, then we can keep ourselves away from this world's increasing angst. And please, don't throw any tantrums in Walmart.